week of May 26, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 450, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Welcome back again, Sperling.
It's good to be back.
You're still back.
I'm still back, yes.
When is your next trip?
Next trip is to Cine Europe in June.
Oh, very exciting. Are you going to do the show from Cine Europe, or are you just going to say, you're going to blow off all our fans?
I'm sorry you're breaking up. I can't hear
yeah,
you.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to break their hearts in a few weeks, at least you can tell them what they're going to hear about on this week's show.
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got the Quasette covered again. The Cannes Film Festival has wrapped up, and we'll discuss the awards, the Palme d'Or, the banner crop of movies unveiled, take the temperature of the market, and decide if Cannes is back. I didn't know it ever went away. Yeah, I'm thinking it's back, actually. In sexual misconduct news, we've got Harvey Weinstein maybe paying out tens of millions to women and employees. CBS's Scott Paley saying he was fired from the Evening News for complaining about the toxic workplace environment that he was in. And there are, of course, growing calls for a boycott of Georgia. On Inside Baseball, we give a 95% fresh rating to the news from Rotten Tomatoes that they're protecting their website from being manipulated by a few bad apples. You see what I did there? I went from tomatoes to apples.
Keep going.
Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Deadline Hollywood, The Numbers, Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, all the major newspapers, and you, our listeners. And of course, in North America, it's Memorial Day weekend. So we had a 4-day weekend. So it's a little more robust than usual. These numbers may track movies anywhere from Thursday to Tuesday or Wednesday to Sunday. Who knows? Because they're numbers coming from all over the world. So we're really kind of talking about the week in box office, not just the weekend. But the number one movie around the world, no matter how you slice it, is Aladdin. Since it opened up last week, it has made $233 million worldwide. So a solid start to the movie. Fans seem to like it more than critics. But boy, all these live action remakes, they are minting money, but they sure are junk.
I did not think this movie would do as well as it did. However, you know what? It's still $233 million. How can you argue with that? You can see why they do it, although I agree with you. I think 50 years from now, we're not going to be talking about Aladdin, the live-action film.
I'm not worried so much about historically or tarnishing their legacy. I'm looking at it purely as a business proposition. They are minting money, and it doesn't always work. Dumbo, which is just not a property that's as recent or, to my mind, as relevant. I know other people admired the movie. I think it's not a particularly good animated film, whereas Aladdin, I think, is one of their best. I think it's a terrific action film. I never understood why they didn't make more feature film sequels. I know they did direct-to-video, but along with Tarzan, Aladdin seemed, you know, well-suited to a sequel, and I thought they would do one, but they never did. But you're looking at these, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and again, The Lion King coming up. It looks like a shot-by-shot live-action, sort of live-action remake. You know, it looks like animals, though it's really animation again, or computer imagery. Are they hurting their properties, though? Are they going to make these seem also-rans or less interesting? You know, you make money today, but 5-10 years from now, does it make the properties and the rides and the stuff a little less exciting? I guess not, but it's something to worry about, I think.
Yeah, I was really surprised that they chose Aladdin.
Great reviews. It's a perfect one. It's a great review. You can do it live action. Terrific songs. It's great, you know, great music. So, and there's been a dozen, 20 plus movies about Aladdin. You know, this is not exactly a new property.
Arabian Nights.
Yeah,
right?
There's no reason not to do a live action, but why not make a new movie on the property? I don't mean an entirely different one, but they just seem to be sort of recreating the film. It's like a theme park ride, you know, where that can be sort of fun, but you're remaking a movie you've already made really well, and you're just sort of tracing over it rather than doing something creative. And I don't mean it should be radically different, but I don't know, but to me, they're just sort of grounding it into the dirt.
Did you see the live-action Aladdin?
I did not, because you know what I saw? I saw our number two film around the world, John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum, and it was awesome. Oh my God. Over the last week, it has made $50 million. Since it's opened up, it's made about $180 million worldwide. It has passed John Wick 2. It's now the John Wickiest of the John Wick films. It's better than part 2, pretty much as good as part 1, and it is unbelievably violent. Oh my God, well, is it violent? First film was super violent. This one is more violent. It's really, really violent. But somehow it captures a video game aesthetic, and I don't know how they do it, but it has a certain wit and charm about it. It's fun, that the fact that it's sort of like a video game. You know, the constant sort of increasing in tension and people coming at you from all directions, and you're doing something in one room while someone you're playing the game with, you know, in a multiplayer game, you know, your friend is in another room fighting off villains. Every once in a while, you can see someone in the film fighting in another room, doing the same stuff you're doing, that John Wick is doing. And it has a goofy, dumb appeal to me. It's a lot better than your average bear. But boy, if you're not into action and you don't want violence, you know, stay away. But I like it. There's certainly a John Wick 4. They've already set it up. So more John Wick to come.
Well, have you seen Pokemon, the
I have not.
Detective
That's our number,
Pikachu movie?
Our number 3 movie around the world. And remember, they're not competing against each other. It doesn't matter who's at number 1 or number 3, because some movies are just opening up. Others have been out for weeks. Some are only in 4 territories. Others are open up in 80 territories. So this is just to help you keep track of where we are in our listing. But the fact that Pokemon Detective Pikachu, it made $37 million in the past week. It's at about $350 million worldwide. So it's going to be profitable. It needs to make about $450-500 million to be in the black, at least just from box office alone. And so that's going to get there. It's doing well. It's not exploding. It's not disappointing. And number 4 around the world is a movie that has exploded. It's Avengers Endgame. Another $32 million over the past few days. It's at $2,677,000,000 worldwide. It needs about $110 million more to become the highest grossing film of all time worldwide, not adjusting for box office inflation. And speaking of Avengers and the Marvel world and Stan Lee, the former business manager of Stan Lee has been arrested on elder abuse charges. So we'll be looking forward to seeing what happens there. But it was a sad, ugly ending to Stan Lee's life. And if people misbehaved, as it seems like they did, it's nice to see that maybe they're going to pay a price.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of sad because there was some question about it while he was still alive as to whether there was elder abuse taking place. And when somebody could have done something about it, nobody did.
Well, it was written about and talked about. People were trying. There was a battle and fight over it. But yes, it's sad that he did not have the happy end of life that all people deserve. And number 5 around the world is Brightburn. Is this? I forget. Is this a horror film?
Yeah, I think it's about. It's kind of about a superhero, right? Like I don't know. I mean, I was surprised to see this film on the list.
Look it up while I look it up. Brightburn opened up over the last few days. It's made $15 million worldwide. It only cost about $6 million to make. It's from Sony. And so it's off to a very good start given its reported budget. And number 6 around the world is A Dog's Journey. That made another $10 million over the last week. It's at $46 million worldwide.
So here's Brightburn, okay? Mm-hmm. It's actually an interesting premise. What if a child from another world crash-landed on Earth, okay?
Right. E.T. has come, but he's not nice.
Correct.
Well, that's, you know, aliens have often come to kick our ass. But yeah, it's sort of an
it's not Superman. It's Horrible Man.
Exactly. And number 7 around the world is The Hustle, the poor remake of a very good comedy film, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, one of the best films of the 80s. $8 million over the last week. $66 million worldwide for the female comedy duo of Rebel Wilson and Anne Hathaway. There's another female duo on top of the charts at number 8. That's Booksmart. That's about two high school friends who are headed to the prom after party. It made about $6 million in its opening week and got pretty good reviews. However, critics liked it more than fans. It seemed like it would be a broad, appealing comedy that people might take to their heart, but it turns out that critics have been a little more high on this movie since it opened up, I think, at South by Southwest. That's where it made its debut, I think. I don't believe it was Sundance, but critics really liked it a lot. Audiences are like, eh. And number 9 around the world is a Korean action film we've already talked about, The Gangster, the Cop, and the Devil. That made another...
Which I did not see in Cannes because it played opposite something that I
And it was
I
at midnight. It made about $6 million. It's at $17, $18 million worldwide. There is a movie that did debut at Cannes, Rocket Man, the story of Elton John. That could be an Oscar hopeful along with a number of films that played at Cannes. There are a lot of Oscar potential movies that opened at Cannes. This movie has opened up in just the United Kingdom. It made $6 million. It's tracking very well. And now, what is the bar that we're going to compare this movie to? Is it Bohemian Rhapsody?
I guess so, because it's the most recent, even though, frankly, it should just be any musical biopic.
Well, I don't really care about genre, but we know it cost about $40 million to make. So the bar that we should set for it is it needs to gross about $120 million worldwide if you expect this movie to make anywhere near the $900 million phenomenon that was Bohemian Rhapsody. That's a crazy standard. That's like saying a movie with a boat in it should make more than Titanic. That's just not a reasonable comparison. If this movie can make $200 million worldwide, it's a big success story. Got good reviews, better than Bohemian Rhapsody. We'll have to see where it ends up.
That's why the makers and producers of The Perfect Storm are like, I don't know. I don't get it. We had a boat. Our boat sank. What's wrong with you people?
It made good money. George Clooney became a star. At number 11 is a new film. It's Mayday Life 3D. Mayday is a Taiwanese boy band. Their last tour was called the Life Tour. So this is a concert film in 3D. See the boys in 3D. Have BTS done that? I think they must have. But it played around the world and it made $5.5 million. At number 12 is The Secret Life of Pets 2, a sequel to the original. We don't know what this one cost, but the original cost about $75 million. It was actually pretty funny. I saw it. The reviews are a little more mixed on this one, but it should probably do just fine worldwide. It's opened up overseas, and it made about $4 million in its opening weekend in one territory. So there's a long way to go for The Secret Life of Pets 2, but it's a decent start for that movie. Scrolling down, Almodovar's film Pain and Glory, one of the big critical successes at Cannes, and it also won Best Actor for Antonio Banderas. That is still playing in markets. It made $2 million. It's now at $12 million and counting. That's got a long, long life ahead of it. Capernaum, that Lebanese drama, one of the best films of last year, that's about to hit $70 million worldwide. It was a big success story before it hit Cannes, because this movie has made about $20 million worldwide, but it's now made another $50 million in China. That is mind-blowing. I cannot explain it, other than we've seen for years now, we've talked about on this show, how the Chinese people are a lot more international and sophisticated. We see a lot more movies scoring big at the box office in China, even than we do in the U.S. We're seeing Bollywood films creep into the top 10 for a week, maybe, in the U.S. China is turning those films into hit after hit at a substantial level. And now they've done it with a Lebanese drama. They're open to Hollywood, Korean, Bollywood, you name it. They have got good taste.
I wouldn't be surprised if Capernaum, if it had played this year in Cannes, if it took home the top prize, the Palme d'Or.
Well, it was a great year, so I don't know about that. You had three or four films in competition that had a lot of heat on them and all sound like they were pretty darn deserving. So I think, unlike other years, this is a year where you could say, I don't know who's going to win, but they've got three or four choices and they can't go too wrong. Any one of those are very, you know, justified. So, you know, I don't think Capernaum would be a lock because there were three or four other really, really good movies. But it certainly is a film that, you know, would have played in Cannes. Maybe it did.
Did it? Capernaum? Yeah. It absolutely did play in Cannes. It was, I think it won the jury prize of the Grand Prix last year.
Well, wonderful. And finally, there's another new movie on the charts. It also came to Cannes. It's The Traitor. It's an Italian drama about the first mafioso to cut a deal with prosecutors. It played at Cannes, and now it's opened up in one territory, $1.4 million on its opening week.
And it's a good film. It's kind of a, you know, it took place in both Italy and Brazil, since the, you know, I'm not spoiling anything. It's a true story. The guy ran off to Brazil and lived there for a little while. And it's an interesting film.
Well, I think you liked it perhaps a little bit more than others. Most of the American critics, at least, were sort of like, eh. You know, seems more like a TV movie or whatever. They've heard about turncoats in the I don't like to call these people rats, because that implies that people who stay true to Omerta are somehow noble and honorable, which is BS, because they're all criminals and gangsters. So don't call the guy who cuts a deal with the cops a rat, because they're all rats. They're all vile, hateful people. They're in the mafia. You can't betray evil, hateful people. You can't.
Well, if you see this film, you will know one thing: the mafia is an invention of the press.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. So you know, that's in Italy, that's in France, and now we move to the Middle Kingdom, where Chinese politics and trade wars with the United States are sort of roiling things in the entertainment biz. We've been sort of braced for whether Trump's trade war with China will affect the movie and entertainment business, because that's the focus of this podcast. And yes, it's happening. A couple interesting things. There's a Chinese TV series called Over the Sea, I Come to You. It's about a student and other students studying in the U.S. And it's a Chinese drama for Chinese audiences. And it was abruptly yanked right before its premiere. No explanation, but they're thinking, well, they just don't want to talk about people in the U.S. and the U.S. in any sort of a light that might be seen as positive. Even worse, this is unbelievable. Tencent is one of the top, I guess, streaming services in China.
Well, it's a big tech company, yeah.
But they have a streaming service. They don't have a TV channel as such, I don't think.
Correct, yes.
Right.
No, they're
But they had the rights to HBO's Game of Thrones, and they showed every episode except the finale. They didn't show the finale. Oh, my God. To which some Americans might say, lucky you. I can't believe what's his name became. No, so we're not going to spoil Game of Thrones because people are still catching up. But oh, my God, no explanation whatsoever. They just didn't show it. And they're thinking, it's how does that help or hurt the trade war? It just punishes the people who've been watching the show. It's not like HBO made less money or something, but that's just crazy. So, you know, things are getting weird. And that leads us right into Cannes, does it? Because there was another film yanked from a film festival by the Chinese government.
Yeah, I guess they yanked Summer of Changsha. It was, I don't even know what, I guess it was supposed to appear in Uncertain Regard.
Oui.
Yeah, so I don't know why they pulled it.
Technical reasons, but they believe it was the political content of the film. But certainly it's the government. Nothing happens without the government, and they decided to yank the film. It's the third time in a row. What's embarrassing here is not that they prevented a film from being shown at a festival, because they've done that a lot in the past, but the fact that it's done so clumsily, they should have just never had the film there in the first place. Then nobody would know it wasn't allowed to be at the festival. So, you know, you're trying to have a good propaganda. You want the soft propaganda of the film industry to help promote your country. Okay. One smart way to do that is to not look clumsy and stupid by offering up films and then yanking them back again.
And there were plenty of other films that did actually screen at the festival and weren't yanked by their countries.
That's right. And a lot of the coverage in the trades was really irking me this year. It seemed like Variety and The Hollywood Reporter kept describing the length of the standing ovation at the public screening.
I'm with you on this. It's like, why bother covering that? Every film gets a standing ovation. They give a standing ovation before the film starts, when the filmmaker and l'équipe, the cast and crew, are announced and are marched into the Theatre Lumière, the Grand Theatre Lumière in the Palais des Festivals. There's a standing ovation. They haven't done anything yet. The film could be horrible. And they get a standing ovation.
Right.
And it's like,
and
why?
Then even after it's horrible, they still give it a standing ovation when it's over. So they've been doing like, this got a 5-minute ovation. This got a 7-minute ovation. This one got a 6-minute ovation. Please, it's meaningless. If somehow a movie got a 20-minute ovation and people wept and yanked up their chairs and threw them on the stage at the public screening, you might say, okay. That's news.
That's news,
At the critic screening, which now takes place during or after or the next 2 days, you used to be in the morning at the critic screening when they were lustily cheering or booing a film. That meant something because they weren't the public who were just there to see a good movie and felt obliged and polite to give a standing ovation to the people. They're seeing one movie at the festival. They want to like it. And so they applaud politely the people who are there. When the critics did something, okay, now you're reporting something that matters. You know, 30% of them booed and 70% cheered crazily. That's information. That's actual news. But the public screenings are pointless. So I wish the trades would just stop it. They know better, which is why it's so upsetting to me. They know it's meaningless, and yet they're reporting it as if it means something. So I find it disturbing.
And I actually just wanted to stay through the entire 3.5 hours of Mektoub My Love, Intermezzo, not because it was a good movie. It was a horrible movie.
It's the least liked film of Cannes, I believe.
Yes, and it's basically...
it's from the director of Blue is the Warmest Color, which won the Palme d'Or a few years ago, a little bit controversially, and certainly he has not done well by himself with this follow-up film, which got widely derided. It wasn't like people didn't like it. They're like, this is junk.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically 3.5 hours of twerking, and, you know, Kashish, Abdul-Latif Kashish is the director's name. He made a 3.5 hour movie about butts.
And butts, female butts, specifically.
Yes.
Mostly, because, you know, if it was half guy butts, I might be more into the movie.
Well, it's just, it's so boring, and I at some point I wanted to sit through the whole thing
just to see
like, are people even still awake? Because he demanded or insisted that his 3.5 hour movie start at 10 p.m.
Oh, goody.
Yeah. And I can see why, because most of it takes place in a nightclub.
Yeah.
But still, started at 8, okay?
Well, that was his reaction to the film. And I think the other thing, we had standing ovations. We had, you know, the typical story of an auteur that kind of supporting didn't do that well. First, there was him. And then there was Xavier Dolan, one of my favorite directors, who's had now 2 or 3 films in a row that have been pretty poorly received. This year, he had, Matthias and...
Matthias and Maxime. And it's not a bad movie. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, an average. It's like, okay.
Did you see this
competent
movie? It's a film about two straight guys who are making a movie or doing something artistic together, and they have to kiss on camera. And then they have feelings to deal with after that, maybe.
Correct.
Did you see this film with Steven?
I did see this film with Steven. However,
he
saw
it. Was it awkward?
No, it was not awkward.
You guys didn't have to talk about that night a couple years ago at Con? No?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
No,
good.
Not at all.
And so that was one of the movies. But typically, this was an excellent banner year. Looking at it from the U.S., we had 3 to 5 films that were raved about by most everyone. And so going to the Palme d'Or, I don't think you could have had a sense of who was going to win, because people really, really loved Pain and Glory, the Almodovar film. They loved Portrait of a Young Lady on Fire by Celine Sciamma. There was certainly passionate response for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which you were mixed on, and a fair number of people were, but there were also really strong adherents, so it wouldn't have been a shock if that had won. And people were crazy for Parasite, the Bong Joon-ho film. You know, returning to his roots, returning to his original language in Korea. And that was a movie that people were nuts about.
Yeah. Okay. So there, this year's festival, in a way, there was before Tarantino and after Tarantino,
mm-hmm.
because they played Once Upon a Time in Hollywood on Tuesday. So past the halfway point, but still, you know, it kind of like led up to this crescendo of Tarantino.
But it ends on Saturday instead of Sunday now, right?
Correct.
Right.
Yes.
So really, you know, Thursday is the new Friday, and it was always dead come Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So now you're saying it's dead Thursday, Friday, Saturday. That's the way Cannes always is. People take off. They don't stay
yes.
till the end.
No, I just meant film-wise in terms of like what was shown. And the day that Once Upon a Time played, it played at 7 o'clock. And then the 10 o'clock screening was Bong Joon-ho's Parasite.
Oh, boy.
And both filmmakers, one via email and one in person, requested that there be no spoilers. And I felt bad for Henri Béhar. He had to, in front of like all of the press screening, he had to say that Quentin Tarantino and the producers request that there be no spoilers. And he was, you know, people were yelling at him on stage. I felt bad for him. Because I think that they felt belittled that Tarantino would have to tell a bunch of critics not to spoil the movie.
Right, that's so stupid, but I don't know why they would take it out on him.
Yeah, I agree. Don't shoot the messenger.
Thanks for telling us our job, and we'll do what we want. Right.
I guess.
Yeah. So, but your response is a little different after having seen the films.
Yes, my response would be, what could you possibly ruin in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? I mean, there's like nothing going on in the movie.
Because we know the setup of the film. A star and his stuntman, and against the backdrop of the Manson murders.
Correct.
Right. So there's nothing to spoil there. On the other hand, Parasite?
Parasite, you could actually pull a muscle trying to spoil that movie, because there are so many spoilers. It twists, it turns, the plot is amazing. It's just insane. It's a great movie. And it definitely received the biggest response of the screenings that I saw. And I saw close to 30 films, maybe even 30 films. And without a doubt, that got the strongest response at a press screen.
And thus, when Bong Joon-ho's film became the winner of the Palme d'Or, the first Korean film to win the top prize at Cannes, it was one of those years where everybody was like, yes, that was absolutely well-deserved and a good choice.
Yeah, it's rare that the critics and the Palme d'Or winner are the same.
But it could have been Pain and Glory by Almodovar that also got excellent reviews all across the board.
Yes, this is the latest film from Almodovar out of Spain, who kind of, it's kind of semi-autobiographical, and Antonio Banderas, who won the Best Actor Award, by the way, for the film. He's kind of playing an Almodovar-like character.
That's right. And the only puzzle to me was Celine Sciamma, a terrific director. I interviewed her at Cannes, which I'm proud to do. I saw her first film and ran over and said, I want to interview her, and got to chat with her, followed her career. Everything she's done has been very strong, solid, and interesting. And now here she is with Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And yet they didn't give her Best Director. They didn't give her runner-up, the Grand Prix Award, which went to a film directed by a Black woman, the first film ever directed in competition by a Black woman, Atlantiques. And that's cool, though you were mixed on it, and it sort of had a mixed review, though we've seen some people say it was one of the best first features of Cannes. But Celine Sciamma got Best Screenplay, and instead, she should have been given at least Best Director, which went to easily the most puzzling decision of the jury, which is giving that award, Best Director, to the Dardenne brothers.
Yes, for Young Ahmed, a film about a young boy who's like 14, 15 years
radicalized
old. Who's radicalized.
Yes.
And, you know, it's just, it's not a horrible movie. It isn't. It's just a movie.
It was
and
indifferently received by everyone.
Yes.
Nobody needed this movie to get any award or any prize whatsoever. They're among the most honored people who have ever attended Cannes in history. They've got plenty of awards on them. They surely would not have been upset or confused if their poorly reviewed, indifferently received movie walked away empty-handed. So why they gave them Best Director is a puzzle when they could have given it to Celine Sciamma.
Yeah, it just, it doesn't, I don't get it.
But you had a great year. You saw about 28 to 30 movies. You gave four films a perfect 4 stars. You gave 9 films 3 stars. Which means you saw almost half of your movies were good to great. And in fact, you found a movie in a sidebar, Beanpole, that a lot of critics didn't see. Because unlike the films in competition, there aren't 2 or 3 or 4 screenings of them. You saw this movie, Beanpole, by a young Russian director. That's going to probably get a lot of attention down the road. And people will sort of wake up to, oh yeah, that movie debuted at Cannes and it was really good.
Yeah, I mean, this is a film that is set in Leningrad right after World War II.
Yeah, we talked about it last week.
Yeah, and it's a really good movie. And it's one of those films where you kind of look at the description of it and you go, this could go either way, but it's from a Russian filmmaker. And for some reason, they've been making great movies lately, along with Romanian filmmakers. So I took a flyer on it, and it was really good.
No, that's cool. Well, I'm going to keep my eye out for that. And I always check out Le Film Français, which is a roundup of European critics, and Screen Daily, which has also a roundup of mostly European critics, but usually English language ones, a little more so in that case. And IndieWire just released their list of 50 critics, including you and Stephen Garrett, our friend. And I think all of the lists are pretty much in agreement. Parasite, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, The Lighthouse, Pain and Glory, and to a degree, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, were all really well-reviewed movies, had strong adherence, if not completely across-the-board admiration. So that looks like a really good con, which makes me wonder, why did Todd McCarthy call it a quiet con? As far as I could see, was one really good movie after another.
Well, I guess maybe because there was, you know, you had Rocket Man, lots of glitz and glamour with that. You had Elton John there and Taron Egerton.
Yeah.
And then you had, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, lots of star power there with Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt showing up and Margot Robbie and, of course, Tarantino himself. But there were very few big star-driven movies.
Well, that's
and
not what Todd McCarthy cares about. He was talking about the art film market. And that's what that's what he's saying. Where are these movies going to play? We still have the backdrop of worrying about streaming. We still have the backdrop of like, who's going to pay for these movies and where will they be seen after Cannes is over? Well, I don't think that's a new issue. It's not like 30 years ago, Cannes would show a movie and it would play on 30,000 screens around the world. You know, just a big hit at Cannes meant it was, you know, the Dardenne brothers do not get played all. Yes. Once in a while, they have something like Pulp Fiction, but most of the time, they have something like the Dardenne brothers, who are great filmmakers and have made movies that have been seen all over the world, but they're not exactly box office monsters.
Right. And there's always been the question about what the Palme d'Or, the top prize in Cannes, is worth. Does it actually help box office?
No.
And
in
it's
Europe.
Questionable.
In Europe, they
in
say.
Europe, maybe.
Right, maybe.
But yeah, it's definitely not a guaranteed box office hit.
Right. So he's just saying, but yeah, where is the art market going? Who is going to see these movies and how? Will they only be seen on streaming services? We certainly saw Amazon and other players picking up movies.
Yeah, I mean, I think Atlantique was picked up by Netflix, and
they also picked up the animated film, which I'm really intrigued by, called I Lost My Body, about a hand that has been severed from its body and crawls around like the Thing from Adam's Family, trying to find its home again.
Yeah, and there was some talk about that. But, you know, then you also had Fox Searchlight, I guess with some of that Avengers money, buying A Hidden Life, Terrence Malick's three-hour movie that is set during World War II in Austria. And I thought it was a great first 2 hours, and because it had a third hour, it went from masterpiece to very poor, in my opinion. I am amongst the minority there.
No, it's pretty widely split. Very few people thought it was great. A lot of people thought it was better than his last three, but that's
which
a low
isn't
bar.
Saying much.
Right, it's not saying much. They thought it was good, which is a lot better than awful, but very few people said, oh my God, it's genius unparalleled, and a lot of people had issues with it, just like you.
Well, but $14 million?
That's crazy.
Nobody can understand why Fox Searchlight paid that much money. Now, there are some conspiracy theories that people believe, oh, well, this is Disney's way of...
Don't repeat a stupid conspiracy theory that you don't believe has any knowledge or anything.
Well,
it
actually very well, it is a genuine theory that I believe could actually be accurate, which is that they're letting Fox Searchlight spend lots of money on, you know, movies to then turn around a year later and say, you see, you guys don't know what you're doing. We're going to shut you down.
That's absurd. They're not saying, if they want to shut them down, they will shut them down. They don't need to have them lose lots of money. They paid $13, $14 million for the movie, and it was approved by their higher-ups because they think they can make money on it, period. And Disney's not letting them spend profligate amounts of money so they can then have an excuse to shut them down. They don't need an excuse to shut them down. They're worth $10 gazillion. That's absurd. So, anyway, don't you think that's absurd?
It's absurd.
They don't need an excuse to
Disney has been, relentless and ruthless in terms of what they shut down.
They own it. It's their decision. They don't need to justify themselves to anyone. They're not going to get any blowback. How dare you shut down Fox Searchlight? It doesn't matter. They are free to do whatever they want, and they're not going to waste money in order to have an excuse to shut something down. That's
well,
silly.
That was but that was by far the highest amount paid for a film in Cannes this year.
As
that
a straight
was
pickup, yeah.
Yeah, as a straight pickup. Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly it was a very good year film-wise. I mean, certainly The Lighthouse, this is the black and white second film from Robert Eggers, who directed The Witch.
Which I thought was quite good, too.
Yeah, and this film maybe not as good, I would not be surprised to see Willem Dafoe at the end of the year come award season.
Well, and after seeing Robert Pattinson?
Robert Pattinson, a little less so.
I saw him in the Claire Denis High Life, the sci-fi flick. I saw that in the theater, and I really liked it a lot, actually. I thought it was a good movie, very interesting. At the end of the movie, there's a cool song on the soundtrack singing, Willow, Willow. And I'm like, what is this? I don't know this at all. It turned out to be by the Tinder Sticks with vocals by Robert Pattinson. So
go figure.
He's having a banner year. He's singing songs. He's making sci-fi flicks with Claire Denis and now a black and white flick with Willem Dafoe. Who would have thunk the two stars of Twilight would prove so popular with auteur directors? It's unbelievable.
Well, I think basically, in a way, Twilight has given Robert Pattinson at least the financial freedom to go and do all of these.
Well, of course, but that doesn't mean talent-wise you didn't think, oh, wow, these two actors are going to be snapped up by all the best directors around the world, but they have been. Both of them.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Totally bizarre. So you never know. I always try not to rule people out and say, I have no talent. You never know. It wasn't the right project, right material. Curtis Hanson, I didn't think was much of a director. Suddenly, out of nowhere, he did L.A. Confidential, which is a great film, and followed it up with Wonder Boys, which is quite a good film. So you just never know. So I try to champion people and not be dismissive of people, even if they're doing something I don't think is good. You know, you just never know. And he's done enough good work now that anybody who said, what a talented hack, you know, had it wrong. But it,
well, certainly the programmers of Cannes this year had it right for the most part.
Well, that's because of the crop of movies, right? Isn't it? I mean, we don't want to overpraise them. They just had a lot of good movies to choose from, right?
That's right. Yeah. Yes, and frankly, I hope Parasite does gangbusters.
Well, I can't wait to see it, and I can't wait to see all the movies being made in Georgia, assuming they ever get made.
Yeah, I don't think actually you're going to have a long wait, is what I'm trying to say.
Right, that takes us into sexual misconduct news. We mentioned last week how there was sort of a move among Hollywood to try and be a little more coy. Some people are calling for a boycott of Georgia because of new anti-women laws that have been passed in that state. And some people are hoping they can get away with, or just feel logistically they have no choice at this stage. They've got projects filming or about to film in Georgia. And they're thinking, well, we're going to make the movies anyway, give the jobs to the people in our industry who deserve them, and we will donate our own personal fees to fight these laws via the ACLU or some women's rights projects involving abortion rights and pro-choice rights, and hope that that's enough. But more stuff is happening, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you have Stacey Abrams, the former governor, saying, please don't boycott us because we actually need the money. And then you've got people like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar making a very good case as to why they need to, why these states like Georgia and Alabama need to be boycotted over such laws.
Yeah, some people say, well, they don't work, they don't matter, but that's not an argument for not doing it. You know, you may not do it because you think you're going to bring the state down, but you say, I can't ethically do business here. I prefer to go somewhere else. So your choice in doing a boycott is not necessarily to say, change your laws or we'll never come back. It might just be saying, I don't want to work in apartheid South Africa. Nothing to do, you know, I'm leaving. And in fact, we know it works because it has worked in other states at other times, like North Carolina. But we do have Kristen Wiig, who is about to do a new buddy comedy in the state. She's doing that with Lionsgate, and they have pulled the project and are going somewhere else. Amazon, they have a 10-part drama called The Power.
That's based on a book, I think, because I think I read that book.
That's about the teen girls, yes, who get electrical powers.
Like all girls now have electric power.
That's right. You hit puberty, yeah, and you get electric powers. It's a fun metaphor for the world we live in. I don't know if metaphor is the right word. I think it's an allegory.
Analog? Yeah.
They have canceled plans to shoot some of the show in Georgia. And as you said, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, we have a good link in our show notes to why he thinks, no, you really do need to do boycotts.
Well, I wonder if there's going to be any boycotts of CBS News. I highly doubt it, but Scott Pelley would like it if you did not watch CBS Evening News.
That's not true. He didn't say that. However, he is a correspondent.
I'm making it up.
Oh, well, good.
I'm making it up as a way to try and talk about Scott Pelley and CBS Evening News.
He's a longtime correspondent for CBS. He's on 60 Minutes right now. And for about 10 years, 8 years, I forget what his period was, he was the anchor of CBS Evening News. And now in a new interview, he said he lost that gig because he complained about a toxic workplace environment. He didn't go into detail about what specifically he was complaining about, but he said he was very upset, and not about treatment of himself, I don't think, as much treatment around people around him and the toxic environment. He complained to his bosses. They did nothing. Then he went to their boss. Nothing. Finally, he took it all the way up to Les Moonves, who was then the head of CBS. There's an irony for you. He spoke with him for an hour, a very detailed, pointed, clear conversation about all the issues he had and what he thought was wrong. And Les Moonves paid a lot of attention, asked thoughtful questions, and then nothing happened. And the next time Scott Pelley's contract came up for renewal, he was dumped from the Evening News. And you know,
right. Well, there was also a new head at that point too, wasn't there?
Les Moonves, you mean? No.
No, a new head of CBS News.
I don't know that. Les Moonves was still in charge. And I remember at the time being a little puzzled because he had taken CBS Evening News to their best ratings in a decade at one point during his stint. It is true that at the very end when he was fired, they had dropped from the previous year. But Evening News is a long, slow-turning monster. You know, things happen very slowly in the Evening News, like the Morning News. So typically, I thought that was a weird overreaction to a guy that had done very well for quite a while for the CBS Evening News. And I assumed it was maybe because he's older and they wanted to go younger or something. I just didn't really understand that decision at the time. So you know what? Hearing what he said now, I go, maybe he's right.
Well, that brings us to actor Jason Mitchell.
That's right. He has lost a couple jobs. He's also lost his representation. Some people say, oh, his agent fired him. But I don't think that's quite the way to word it, right? You know, they've dumped a client. So they're refusing to represent them. They don't fire them because, again, your agent is not your owner or your boss. They don't hire you. You hire them and they represent you.
Yeah, it's, so, I agree with you. It's industry terminology that has always been flawed.
Because you're an agent. Right. So what happened? He is a rising star. He played Eazy-E in the film Straight Outta Compton. And now he's on the show called The Chi on Showtime, but he's been dropped from that series. Reportedly, several actresses on the show registered complaints about his misconduct. Specifically, actress Tiffany Boone, try again, Michael. Actress Tiffany Boone played his girlfriend on the show. She made numerous complaints about him and was so uncomfortable around him. Her fiance would come on the set on the days when she and Jason Mitchell shot scenes together. And finally, she just asked to be released from the show. She asked to leave a role on a hit TV show because of a fellow actor's behavior. Do you know how crazy that is that you would have to do that? Actors don't leave shows, hit shows. Tiffany Boone is not getting showered with job offers. So to say, I want off this show, tells you how bad she felt the conditions were with her relationship with Jason Mitchell. And of course, she had to leave, not him. Well, now, after an investigation and other things happened, he has been dropped from the TV show. His agents at UTA and his manager have also stopped working with him. He's been dropped from the upcoming Netflix film Desperados. So, he hasn't been found guilty of anything, but looking at workplace environment, there's a difference between someone you don't want to work with and someone who should be in jail. This guy, there's different legal standards. A lot of people complained about him, and for a change, instead of all the women having to move on and get out of his way, he's the one who's lost a job. So that's a good sea change. And before you say, well, he's not guilty in the court of law, it's like, that's not the standard of a workplace environment. So I think this is a great
thing. Remember when David Caruso left NYPD Blue? It was
he left after season one because he wanted to be a movie star.
Season two. Yeah, he wanted to be a movie star after two seasons, and that didn't really work out so well.
No, and then he ended up on CSI Miami. But what does that have to do with this?
No, I'm saying it's very rare.
Yes, that's a famously dumb idea. The fact that he's talented enough or enough of a TV star to have actually had a second chance and scored so well with CSI is a credit to his actual talent. But yeah, that was one of the more dumbass moves you've ever seen. And I think he acknowledges that now. And of course, one of the other dumbass moves is working with Harvey Weinstein.
It wasn't that way for many years, but it turns out it was that way.
It was if you knew him, wasn't it?
Exactly.
It's like Scott Rudin and these other people. Maybe Scott Rudin is a different person now, but when you hear horror stories about these producers and people throwing phones at their assistants, yelling and screaming at people, treating them like dirt, I wouldn't want to go within 100 miles of them. Harvey Weinstein did not strike me as a person I wanted to do business with. I understand you're a filmmaker. That's different from working at Miramax or the Weinstein Company and putting yourself around him day in and day out. I don't fault anyone who got up on their career ladder by working there, but I sure thought, gee, that's not someone I want to hang out with. And guess what? Now we know what a pig he was, what an awful, awful person. And there's a potential deal on board to pay out $44 million for women and creditors. So he has insurers and people trying to settle a bunch of these lawsuits, and they came up with a deal, tentative deal, that would pay out money to women he sexually assaulted, former Weinstein Company employees, and unsecured creditors. However, a lot of the people involved in this deal are not happy. They don't think it's enough money. It's not been signed off on. And there are a lot of women and other people who are suing him separately who have never been a party to this. So this is far from the end story of Harvey Weinstein. But in the mere fact that you're willing to pay out tens of millions of dollars to people, in part people who say you sexually assaulted them, shows what a dreadful person you are. You just don't do that unless you have to because you're guilty.
Well, yeah, I mean, this doesn't actually resolve any of the criminal allegations.
No. This is personal civil. Yeah. And a lot of it, most of it is just really creditors. So again, this is not even as much about the people who have accused him of sexual misconduct. But still, the fact that they were even willing to make a deal to me is a big deal.
Well, if that's a big deal, it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Well, the standoff between writers and agents, it goes on, it continues.
The beat goes on.
Hey, we're going to copyright. Sorry. Be careful. Yeah. Now, the long holiday weekend, we had a long holiday weekend here in the U.S. It did include some good news for this whole dispute. They're talking again, both sides. The Writers Guild of America and the Association of Talent Agents, the ATA, agreed to resume negotiations, though as of showtime, an actual date to begin hasn't been publicly announced. So really, they're talking about talking again, which is better than talking to the media about why there's no point in talking again. One topic of discussion might be Endeavor. It filed paperwork to go public later this year. The company, an agency, hopes to be valued at around $6 billion and indicated that revenue in its representation division was up 20% in the first quarter compared to 1 year earlier. As the WGA will point out, the salary for most writers, however, has been flat for a decade. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. It's good. But until we hear about somebody moving on one of the main points, which is, of course, packaging and these outside production companies that talent agencies are forming, I don't think it's a huge cause for hope, but I'm glad they're talking. My question to you, however, is do you know when they talk about in that article about the revenue from the representation division, does that mean the division of people who actually rep clients?
Yes, I mean, it's basically, that is their agency.
Right, so, they do more than just rep clients, so that's why it's a particular division, but it's the biggest division for we know that, Endeavor has, they represent models, they represent, they've got lots of stuff going on, but for this representation, that means, okay, you represent this director, this actor, this model, and you get X amount of dollars from what they do.
Right. And it doesn't necessarily mean that, all of the, their salaries increase. They could just be getting more people, more jobs. That's really what where that revenue.
But they're doing good. And that is in the era that we're talking about. So if we're thinking it's gone up 20%, they probably haven't added 20% new clients. It's probably that they're getting more and more money.
Or their clients are working more and more.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say, well, if revenue went up 20%, how come your writer's revenue isn't going up 20%?
It's really, people would say you're comparing apples and oranges there. After 61 years, the music label Warner Brothers Records has changed its name. The company's bold new name, Warner Records. Yes, they've dropped the brothers. Or the Bros, as I like to say.
Warner Bros Records.
Yeah. They've also got a new logo, which looks like a record or a rising sun to the left of the new name. Dropping the Brothers is not an attempt to be gender neutral, but the changes are meant to reflect the company's global outlook and new fortunes. The logo apparently could also be seen as the entire planet Earth. As Warner Records said in a press release, the logo's look suggests, quote, a record, a sun, and a globe, a nod to the label's past, present, and future. The openness of the design gives it the flexibility to embrace all Warner Records artists and all genres of music around the world. This comes on top of the company moving its headquarters to LA's Arts District. Good luck finding parking. Big deal or big whoop?
Is it really hard there? Do they have no parking?
It's downtown.
It's a big whoop. And what in God's name were they thinking?
I have no idea.
Warner Records? Records. Warner 8-tracks. Warner cassettes. Why not Warner Music? I know it's
good
Warner
point.
Music Group, but it's music. You shouldn't link yourself to a format. It's bizarre. If you're going to rethink it, Warner Music. I don't get it. That to me is nutty. But
that's why my record label is going to be named after cassette tapes.
Right. I mean, singles, Warner Singles. I mean, I understand vinyl's back, baby. It's making, a couple hundred million dollars a year, which is great. But, Warner Digital, that would be the future at least. But I would think Warner Music made the most sense when you're going to rethink it. Not link it to a format, link it to the actual thing that you're doing. Oh, well.
The final numbers are in for the 2018-2019 TV season, and as usual...
How did we do?
Well, the ratings have good news for several networks. CBS is number one in total viewers, but NBC is number one in the key 18 to 49-year-old demographic. But NBC is only number one because of one-off events more than ongoing TV shows. So, maybe CBS is number one after all? And the CW is number one definitely in social media, if you factor in the waves it makes on Twitter and the like compared to its actual ratings for TV shows. CBS has been number one in total viewers for years, while NBC has been number one in the key demo, except for the one season that CBS had the Super Bowl. Now, in late night, Stephen Colbert is number one in both total viewers and the key 18 to 49-year-old demo. That's the first time in more than 20 years that show has won in demos, The Late Show.
We're talking way back to when Letterman was, you know, his second season on CBS Late Night.
Yeah, we're talking about the major networks here. And while CBS has good news, it's also saying goodbye to The Big Bang Theory, one of the longest-running shows in TV history. Only a handful of shows have ended their run as the number one show in the country, and The Big Bang Theory is not one of them. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's the season breakdowns. It's interesting. And I do think the networks still hit way above their pay scale in terms of the hundreds of cable channels and the streaming services. They actually deliver a big audience week after week with commercials attached. So it still really matters. That's why they get a lot of attention. But yes, I was a little irked by the coverage. People kept saying, oh, The Big Bang Theory is the number one entertainment scripted show to be number one in its last season, just like blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, no. It did not set the record. Seinfeld, The Andy Griffith Show, and I Love Lucy are the only TV shows to end their runs ranked number one in the Nielsen ratings. Period. No football program, not 60 Minutes, not a news magazine, not a interview show, nothing. They're the only shows in history to end their runs number one in the Nielsen ratings. When you're number one, you typically don't walk away, but those three shows did it. The Big Bang Theory didn't do it. The number one show in the country is Sunday Night Football by a large margin. So yes, Big Bang Theory is described as the number one scripted series. That's nice, but that ain't the game you're playing. And talking about it as if it compares to that, it was number two. It wasn't number one, so give it up. That aside, you want fresh blood, and the networks did have some really good news. The Masked Singer, New Amsterdam, Manifest, America's Got Talent, The Champions, the show hosted by Terry Crews, good for him, and FBI on CBS, they all opened solidly. Returning shows like The Good Doctor, 911, and the third season of This Is Us also showed legs. So it's a lot of good new blood coming in, and that's really important for prime time.
And all those scripted shows, you can watch them overseas. I mean, certainly you can see The Good Doctor in...
They're shown all over the world.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, if you're worried about our viewers caring, oh no, absolutely. The Masked Singer started in another country. That's not a U.S.-created format. So that's a show that they have seen in other versions around the world. It's now finally come to the U.S. And all these other shows, America's Got Talent, that started as Britain's Got Talent. I assume that was the first place where they did that.
I think
it
so.
May have been in another country.
Too, yeah.
But yeah, no, all these shows are formats and or actual shows that travel all over the world. We just don't get to hear a lot about how much money they're making because the networks and studios don't want to talk about it.
It's a lot, and unfortunately, they have a lot of expenses, so...
Oh, unfortunately, yeah. They've made no money.
Well, that was awkward. Best-selling author Naomi Wolf went on BBC Radio to promote her new book, Outrages, Sex, Censorship, and the Criminalization of Love. It covers a lot of territory, but the pivotal focus is on a change in UK laws that criminalized homosexuality and, according to her book, led to the execution of about, dozens of men. Unfortunately for Wolf, her interviewer was a historian, and he pointed out some rather serious mistakes in her work. He read off the definition of the legal term death recorded. That's the legal term, death recorded. To a layperson, that sounds like someone was killed.
Sounds like it to me.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. But in the legal system of 19th century England, the phrase death recorded actually refers to a pardon, not an actual death. Oops. Yeah, the interviewer shared historical evidence confirming one of the people she believed was executed was actually discharged from prison. In fact, there is no historical evidence that anyone in England was ever executed for being gay. Wolf says she's going to look into it and make corrections, but stands by her book. Literally, she's standing right by her book because she's hawking it right now on the side of the road. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. A lot of people say, look what publishers, they don't have fact-checking anymore. They've given up their responsibility. And I want to make two points here. One, publishers never really did that. You know, they never really had fact-checking departments. If a book is legally scary and they think somebody might sue, they'll have their lawyers look at that particular section. But as far as I know, certainly the decades I've been around, and as far as I know going into the past, they've never, ever been responsible for the content of a book. They assume the author does their job. Just like newspapers don't really have fact-checking departments. Getting the facts right is the job of the reporter. just like it's the job of the author of a nonfiction work. So, you know, I've been hired. I've done fact checking on books like Peter Biskin's book about Hollywood in the 70s, Easy Riders and Raging Bulls. I was the fact checker on that because he paid out of his own pocket to have somebody fact check the book, because publishers don't do that and kind of never had. But my alternate point is about Naomi Wolf. I have no opinion of her. I never read The Beauty Myth. She's sort of in the background. I don't quite, you know, I've never paid attention to what she wrote, never really followed her that much. I know you don't have a strong opinion of her either. You were confusing her a little bit with Naomi Klein, which is understandable, the same first name. And when I looked into her, I saw, wow, for years now, she's played fast and loose with facts on a lot of things. And she's gotten a lot of blowback from established people like at The Atlantic and, you know, New Republic and, you know, responsible places that go, wow, she's really not doing her history right, not getting her facts right, messing up a lot of things, both in offhanded conspiracy theories and works that she has published. You know, she makes a lot of public comments, but also books she's put out. She's gotten a lot of blowback for not really doing a good job. And so when you're publishing someone like that, actually, it is your responsibility, even if you don't have a fact-checking department, to say, hey, you've got Naomi Wolf doing a book on 19th century British legal law. Does she know a lot about that? Do you have a reason to think she knows a lot about that? You want to spot check some of that with her to make sure she's on ball here? They don't care because she's making a lot of money, but that is irresponsible. So you know what? They don't have fact-checking departments, but if you see an author with a decade of making misleading or confusing or erroneous comments on matters of history and law and blah, 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 you might want to think twice before you publish their book.
Well, and maybe if you're a musician, you can actually help her out by fact-checking, actually, because you probably
you won't
need
have
some
a
more.
Job.
Yeah. Now, many young musicians may see their pension checks cut by 20% down the road, thus the reference. That's the news from the American Federation of Musicians, which announced more than 20,000 members may face painful cuts needed to keep the pension fund solvent. They need to get approval for reducing benefits, which is why we're hearing about it now, even though the cuts won't begin until late next year and will fall more on younger members and the benefits they might receive in the future rather than current retirees. Why is this happening? The pension fund is valued at $1.8 billion in assets and $3 billion in liability. That is, in the monies it is obliged to pay out in the future based on work already done. In the fiscal year ending in March of 2018, the fund paid out $171 million in benefits, but only brought in $68 million in contributions. In other words, more than $100 million more went out than came in.
Sounds like my daily household finances.
Yeah, in the millions of dollars, absolutely. Yeah. It's unclear if this is due to mismanagement of the funds and risky investments or a broader pattern. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. There was a lot of talk in this article and some others about, oh, the people in charge of the fund messed up. Everybody took a hit during the recession of 2008, but they had then tried to make up for it with even riskier investments, and that blew up in their face. I don't know if that's true, but there's also a larger pattern. The motion picture industry pension plan, that's cost about $4 billion. That's what its value is right now. The SAG pension plan, that's at about $3.8 billion. Both of them have seen declining fortunes in their value. Again, we've had the Great Recession in 2008. It's not clear how much is related to that or mismanagement of the funds or the world we live in. We know there's a lot of states and cities that underfund their pension plans when they should be doing more to put money into it. Maybe part of it's that. And because it's musicians, I thought, well, heck, maybe it's because of the digitization. Suddenly, when you don't have songs on the radio and you don't have songs being played in different ways and people aren't buying LPs, but they are, in fact, yeah, they're not buying records, but they're just streaming it online, there's a lot less money coming in. Maybe that's part of the problem.
Well, also, when you are actually using a synthesizer instead of a horn section or, you know, you're
right. I don't know if there's been any historic long-term trend down of use of musicians, but that would have started in the 60s or 70s, not in the last 5 years. But yeah, so there's a lot going on here. And if you know what the deal is, you have some insight, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where our page can be liked. You know, you throw that to me every single week. I never know when you're going to do it.
It's so exciting. And speaking of musicians and royalties, a cute, nice little note said that the Rolling Stones have handed back songwriting credits to the hit song Bittersweet Symphony. That was a song released by The Verve, written by Richard Ashcroft, the lead singer of that group. I think he had soul writing credit on it. Maybe the other guys did too. But it included a sample from an offbeat 70s symphonic album that adapted Rolling Stone songs into symphonies or symphonic pieces. And they took a little sample of that. So it's this weird little bit of music from that little obscure 70s album, but was technically adapted from the Stones music. They used that sample on their song, and suddenly the Stones management said, yeah, we want like 100% of all the songwriting credits because you use that without authority. So for like a long, long time, the biggest hit of their career, the Stones got all the money. And the Stones like, yeah, you know what? That really was not right because we didn't write the little ditty that you actually sampled. We didn't arrange it. We had nothing to do with it. It's not really based on any song that we wrote. So maybe you should have paid a right to sample it, but to give up all songwriting credits is kind of unfair. So we're now going to hand those back to you and you've got them. To which I assume Richard Ashcroft said, that's nice. What about all the money from the last 20 years when it's been a big hit?
Yeah, exactly. Now, a licensing company has just paid $110 million for Sports Illustrated. I hope they got the swimsuit issue. Now, they're not getting the magazine, just the brand. Under the deal, a company called Authentic Brands, which also owns licensing rights for Marilyn Monroe and Elvis Presley, among others, they gain the right to the intellectual property of the iconic magazine. That means the treasure trove of images, the swimsuit and sports person of the year brands, the name and other assets. It doesn't seem to include the actual journalism that ran in Sports Illustrated and the magazine itself.
Silly words.
Well, you know, it's going to continue to be published by Meredith Publishing. I don't know why now that they've sold it, but anyway, Meredith bought Sports Illustrated as part of a $2.8 billion deal last year. Authentic Brands will pursue opportunities like gambling and esports and live events. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big, dumb, stupid move.
Yeah, I don't know what you're doing if you're Meredith, giving up the name and the right. What are you doing?
Maybe you have no ability or no insight or no track record in doing all the things you might want to do with the Sports Illustrated brand, but you just sell it off for $100 million, which actually seems low if you're going to sell it off. That has to be one of the most valuable brands around. Just to say, oh, here, you take it. That just seems moronic to me. Like, at least do a partnership with someone where you're going to get half the profits. You know, why the hell are you just giving it away for $110 million? Forever? Like if you just had a sports gambling website and that clicked, or swimsuit issue casino slot machines, which probably already exist. But it just seems that seems to be the most valuable part of Sports Illustrated anyway, given the track record of digital and print and, you know, classic media properties like that. The value of Sports Illustrated is in all those offshoots, not in printing the magazine. So this just seems dumb on every level.
Lil Nas X continues to make waves with his country hip-hop novelty number, Old Town Road.
Oh, haven't heard it.
Yeah, do you want me to sing it for you and break a lot of copyright? No.
No, okay.
The song has been number one for almost 2 months now on the Billboard charts.
I beg your
charts.
Pardon, exactly 2 months. It's just been announced while we're on the air that it's number one for 8 weeks in a row, which ties, Seven Rings. Ariana Grande.
Okay. Well,
that's the biggest hit of the year so far.
Well, the official video came out after it hit number one and includes Chris Rock, among others.
Boogity boogity.
And now Lil Nas X has signed a marketing deal with Wrangler Jeans. The website Digital Music News reports that some country fans are calling for a boycott of Wrangler over the deal since the song isn't a real country song. And by the way, it has nothing to do with the fact that Lil Nas X is black. Seriously.
No.
These fans are at loose ends, though. A boycott of Levi's was called for in the past because it seemed to somehow support some gun safety laws. So if they can't wear Levi's and they can't wear Wranglers, what kind of jeans can cowboys wear? Guess, Gloria Vanderbilt's, if they still make those, Sassoon. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, of course, on several levels. Number one, why is Wrangler making this deal? This is a novelty number. By the time they actually get jeans in the stores that they have designed with Lil Nas X cooperation or support, I mean, it's going to be what, 2020? You know? And this song is going to be a distant memory. People go, oh, yeah, that dumb thing. It's like, I understand they want to reach a new audience, maybe younger, hipper people, and maybe people of color. But that's like thinking it's a good idea to partner with the guys who did Macarena. You know, that's just not if you want to reach Hispanic audiences or Spanish, Hispanic, Latino. It's like,
oh,
no,
brother.
maybe he'll have a long career. I don't know. But the idea that you would sign a marketing deal with him for jeans coming out a year from now, long after the song is a tired joke, is just bizarre. I mean, if you wanted to partner with Darius Rucker, who's a big country star, the guy from Hooting the Blowfish, he's a black man. Hooting the Blowfish are touring right now again, celebrating the 25th anniversary of their biggest album as a group.
Shut the front door!
He has had a string of number one hits on the country charts. He's clearly a legacy artist. He's going to be around a long time. So if you want to be true to your country brand and reach people of color, maybe branch out a little bit. You know, Darius Rucker's an older guy. You're not going to get the kids, but what the hell? At least that makes sense, and you're not screwing up your brand. Wrangler is the gene of cowboys. When you go to a rodeo or a bull riding event, everybody wears Wrangler. Cowboys, real cowboys, don't wear anything, but they do not wear Levi's. They wear Wrangler. Maybe there's some bull rider or some cowboy who has a deal and wears Levi. I'm sure that's true. But like 98% of them all wear Wrangler jeans. Those are the authentic jeans. That is your brand. So to partner up with a novelty hit song is just stupid.
Well, I wear Levi's because I pan for gold a lot. And if you don't know that reference, Google it.
I get it. But I always wore Wranglers because I knew I had to buy someone and wanted to go to a bull riding event, not look like an idiot, not stick out. And people go, Yankee. So I think that's stupid of Wrangler, and I'm upset with Digital Music News because I'm finding them a better and better source of information in the music biz. I get their email newsletter. I check them out all the time.
Yeah, they're good.
And this is not a real story. You know what they did? Somebody on Twitter who have no followers said, oh, stupid Wrangler, I'm going to boycott them. That is not a boycott. Nobody of importance. Nobody's organized it. There's not even a stupid
change. Are you trying to say an online media outlet may have written a story solely to get clicks?
Not clicks. Yeah, well, they just made up something. They just, oh, look, they're pretending that somebody posting something on Twitter with 14 followers counts as news. And that's really upsetting. They really shouldn't do that because that's a big problem. And then the only thing that's useful is that the morons who were complaining showed me that, oh, wow, Levi's really did partner with Everytown for Gun Safety, the Michael Bloomberg group, and also donated some money because they wanted to be involved in gun safety after one of the tragedies that hit our country. So good for them. They really did do some stuff to promote gun safety, which is what 90% of Americans support. So good for them.
Now it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And here's how this week's story is going to affect you. You're no longer going to be waylaid into seeing movies that other audiences think are great or bad because Rotten Tomatoes...
Eat them before they've seen them.
Yeah, Rotten Tomatoes is fighting back against trolls. Like Amazon and other online sites, Rotten Tomatoes has a valuable brand in its fresh ratings for movies. They're even used in ad campaigns by studios. Now, to protect the brand, they need to fight off a couple of things. Bots, they need to fight those off. Politically motivated campaigns and passionate fans who want to praise or diss something even before, as you point out, Michael, they've even seen the film.
Right. They finally instituted a few weeks ago. I don't know when that happened, but they said, all right, you know, we're not going to actually let you post reviews till the movies come out because clearly you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
So they said, yeah, maybe we should have held off on that. So fans were writing negative reviews of movies before they even came out. So I'm glad they did that. But some other examples include some right-wing nuts who were posting negative reviews of Star Wars, The Last Jedi, because they decided the films had too many female stars or its message was too liberal. And some right-wing nuts were dissing Captain Marvel because they objected to something star Brie Larson had said in an interview. How'd that boycott work out for you, boys? And some just plain jerks were dissing the female reboot of Ghostbusters, again, writing negative reviews and giving it horrible ratings even before they'd been able to see the movie. So what did they do, Sperling? How did they fix it?
Well, they basically said they're going to verify that you have purchased a ticket, ironically, through Fandango, their sister company.
Well, yes, that's true. I wondered about that because they have an opportunity to do something good. And they're going to say, yes, you have bought a ticket, and therefore you have the right to review this movie. And so they're going to have the main score that they default to will be an audience verified score, meaning if you have actually bought a ticket, you get to review it, and that's the number we're going to show. So that makes sense. But I thought, I hope they're not going to use this good move as a way to sort of isolate and silo and only include Fandango reviews and try to get people to go to Fandango.
Yeah, well, luckily they're not, actually.
Right.
They're working with AMC, Regal, and Cinemark to somehow participate in this and kind of verify, yeah, this is Joe. Joe has seen the movie. Didn't buy a ticket through Fandango, but showed up at the box office, purchased a ticket, and through the loyalty program, we know Joe actually... is an actual person, saw the movie, and can then provide a verified review on Rotten Tomatoes.
Right. So Greg Ferris of Rotten Tomatoes told Hollywood Reporter, quote, ultimately, our goal is to make this as ubiquitous as possible, meaning they want to include as many reviews by verified fans that they can do, not just people who go through Fandango. So I was glad to see that they're not turning something that could be a positive into a negative. So that was good to see. And it makes sense that they would default to that. You know, I wish they would do that with film critics. Right now, they default to all film critics. And I've sent them an email that you really should default to the top critics because, you know, those are the critics that you say are the top critics. That should be the number you default to. But of course, they want to promote their numbers and the all critic review tends to be a little higher. So they're happy to like keep the numbers higher because that means they're more likely to be used in ads. Now, looking at it today, I went to the website. I couldn't see an example of a movie with verified fan score where you could default or go back and forth to the all audience score. I did see that they have separated out the reviews. If you're a verified fan, your review is marked. And you can they just display the verified fan reviews. If you want to see all of them, you can, but they're always going to mark the ones that are actually verified that you actually paid money and saw the movie. So that's cool. And maybe in a few weeks, once enough movies have come out, we'll see that ability to toggle back and forth between the verified score and the total audience score. Right now, I only see one number, but maybe that's just because it's just started today.
Yeah, and when you go there, when you go to Rotten Tomatoes, they have a pop-up that kind of explains everything.
Right. So, you know, this is important. They've got a valuable number there. And, you know, this is why, you know, we wish that they would do something more weighted where they don't value a 2-star review the same as a 4-star review and show a little and give a little more weight to their big number from critics or audiences because, you know, yes or no isn't the same. You know, if every critic thinks the movie's okay, it gets 100% rating. If 90% of them think it's brilliant and 10% of it think it's dreadful, maybe it gets a 70. So their actual number isn't that useful for most fans, but at least they're stepping forward and saying, we want to protect the brand. We want to stop people from manipulating our scores for their own purposes. And they're doing a smart thing. As far as I can tell, it makes sense.
Well, personally, we don't care whether you've listened to the show or not. If you want to rate and review our show, you can.
That's right. Before you do that, I just say Amazon, Facebook, YouTube, they all face the challenges Rotten Tomatoes face of protecting their brand and the reviews and numbers and things that are posted on them. And they're not doing a good job of doing that. Facebook with the Nancy Pelosi thing, Amazon with their reviewer stuff. They have a lot of work to do to make sure that they are protecting their brand. And they don't seem that concerned right now. I think Rotten Tomatoes is doing the right thing. But yes, for the love of God, rate and review the show.
Yes, you can do so in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to our show. You can rate and review the show. It helps other people find the show when you do that. It helps us out when you do that. So please rate, review the show, subscribe to the show. Those links and ways to subscribe to us can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. That's also where you'll find ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. And you can like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where our page can be found. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got something new and exciting for us, a new and exciting website. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's John Wick Forever. Forever. Because the fourth film is going to come out, and I just can't wait.
And I'm sure that website probably hasn't been taken, actually.
Maybe not.
However, if you want to read any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.